Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Bonjour, hola, greetings, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbouet. But that curious word, quiddituzz, what does it mean? Adriana, please give them the definition.
Quiddituzz, Latin, the whatness of a thing, the essential nature of something, the quality that makes a thing what it is.
That's absolutely correct. Quiddituzz is the whatness or essence of a thing or person. And in this episode, I want to talk to you about the power of belief. The power of belief often empowers the highest levels of performance. Performing with a belief is a critical factor of achieving success in anything in life, like sports, school, family, friends. You get the idea. What you believe drives what you do, and what you do determines what you achieve. And what's really interesting about this is that we end up doing things that we never thought we could do until we started believing in ourselves. And that's a thing that I want to press upon, because with my next guest, she had a different path. And we've interviewed, you know, she had a different path. And over the course of this podcast, we've interviewed many different people who started out doing one thing and ended up doing something else. And that second thing ended up being their life choice. It ended up being the thing that they were supposed to do. You know, there's one thing I've learned over the last couple of years while living on this little blue planet is that sometimes life throws you curveballs. What does that mean? Well, basically that means that sometimes things don't go the way you planned. You know, whether it's, you know, something in your relationship or in your business or even if your travel plans, sometimes curveballs are a part of life and you have to learn to expect them and adjust. You know, it reminds me of a quote by Mark Edwards, and that quote is, "You can't control the curveballs life throws at you." So you have to learn how to control yourself and change quickly and make sure the curveball doesn't knock you out. And that's absolutely true. And that's what happened with my next guest. My next guest planned out her life. She went to school after a chance meeting with a celebrity and thought, "I want to become an actress." And so that's what she studied. But then life threw her a curveball and she adjusted. And now, instead of being an actress, she is a sommelier. She's a writer for the New York Magazine, and she's also the founder and creative director of the Vellum Collective. So without further ado, let me introduce to you my guest, Vanessa Price. So I asked this first question of all my guests, and that first question is, when you were like 8 or 9 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh my gosh. I spent the better part of my childhood with my grandmother telling me that I was going to be the first woman president of the United States, which is so ridiculous. But I love that I had a grandma that believed things like that, you know? And so I think that that always just sort of like made me inherently dream big. But for most of my childhood and into like teenage years, I thought that I would be taking like a much more serious route in life in terms of like potentially going into international diplomacy or something like that. That's kind of the background of my family is more in that vein. So, you know, definitely nothing related to hospitality or wine was not even on the radar.
So before we get into how you became a sommelier, I know you had a very different path in mind. So can you tell me in the audience, what did you study during your college years?
Oh, gosh. So basically, long story short, I had a very different path sort of planned out, a scholarship to one of the big schools. This whole plan sort of laid out for me. And I was a senior when 9/11 happened. And my father is in the Navy. And at the time he was a reservist. And I remember asking, you know, like, what does this mean, you know, for us, for the family, and him saying that he didn't know. But then 3 days later, September 14th, 2001, he was shipped out and didn't come home except for like, you know, a week here or there for almost 3 years. And I have three younger brothers and sisters, and, you know, just it kind of turned life upside down for us. And so all the plans that I had thought I had got thrown out the window. And I spent a little bit of time sort of listlessly wandering until I ended up in Miami visiting a girlfriend who was living down in Miami at the time. And it led to a very silly chance encounter that convinced me that I should be a famous actress. And so I set out trying to figure out how to do that. went to conservatory in New York, and then decided to be sensible and get my bachelor's. So I moved back to Kentucky to do that. But I did it like rapid fire. I was a freshman in the spring of 06, and I graduated at the end of 07.
So I happen to know that that encounter in Miami was with actor Matt Damon. But you must have had a flair for acting before that, because you got into a conservatory. So tell me about, you know, your goals. I mean, you did have a flair for the arts, correct?
I think my whole life I've always had a flair, obviously, for the dramatic. But beyond that, I was always drawn to more artistic endeavors, whether it be painting or sculpting or acting or poetry. I was just always drawn more to the arts than I was to the sciences or the math or anything like that. But I grew up in a household that you didn't think about things like, oh yeah, you know, having a career in the arts, that's a valid path. You know, that just wasn't really, you know, it was like, that's what you did until you grew up. And so when I was in Miami, I ended up having this sort of like chance encounter, you know, one night with a group of people that were hanging out with Matt Damon. And of course I was like, you know, and starstruck, you know, in awe. I was like the first celebrity I'd ever seen in real life. And here he was like telling us a story. So you can imagine like how impressionable I was. And he was talking about how he dropped out of Harvard to finish writing Good Will Hunting. And people told him he was crazy. And, you know, look where he is now, Oscar winning, you know, super global celeb. And I remember thinking, yeah, I could do that. I could do that. And so I just sort of set out on this like secret path. I went back to home to Kentucky, and I started figuring out like, okay, how does one become an actor? And, everything said, well, you either go to college for it, or you go to conservatory for it. And it just so happened that just a few weeks later, it was like the timing, you know, was very serendipitous. There was going to be a large casting call / audition process happening in Nashville, which for me was like only 2 hours away. And so for one of the big conservatories in New York. And so I decided, without telling friends, family, anyone, just a drama teacher from high school, that I asked for help on my audition piece. And I drove down to Nashville and stayed the night in a hotel and practiced all night and got up the next day and auditioned and ended up getting like a partial scholarship. They didn't pay for everything, but they paid for a good piece of it. And it was enough that my parents were kind of like, we have no idea what's happening right now, but okay, fine. We'll support you in whatever this path is. Because I think they realized at that time, like, I just needed a path, even if it wasn't going to be the forever path. So I'm grateful that they supported me in that. But very, very circular, weird angle, left, right. Nothing about it was a straight line, that's for sure.
So I guess the big question is, can I see your name in a movie or on a theater playbill?
No. So, okay. Well, I guess I should say I'm a wuss. So we'll just say that from the outset. But basically what happened was I went to conservatory, and it was incredible. It really was. Like, our class was very small. There was only about 30 of us that were in the studio program, which is the straight theater program, not the like the Broadway singing dancing program. And we basically, you know, like one of my former classmates, you know, his kids are my godkids now. And another, you know, we're chatting every day about this and that. And like, you know, so we're all still really close. And some of them have really made a name for themselves in the biz, which has been incredible to watch. But I was not one of them. We graduated, and one of the girls that I graduated with, we decided to get this like hole in a basement of a building in Queens apartment. And I say that with quotations, because it was basically just like a room that we shared. I realized very quickly that I didn't have the stomach to be like a starving actress in New York. I just, you know, I did it for a bit. You know, I did the whole like moving the mattress on the subway and, you know, going to get pastries at midnight from my friend who worked at Starbucks and was like sneaking us the pastries that were supposed to go in the garbage at the end of the day. You know, I did that for a bit. And then I sort of realized like, this hustle is not something I think I could sustain long term. My parents, I think they used it as a lure to sort of get me back to Kentucky, thinking that I would stay. They said they would help me with tuition if I moved home and finished college. And I thought, all right, I'll do this. That would be the smart thing of me to do, right? Like there's a privilege in being able to have help with college tuition, and I should take advantage of this. And so I did.
So this is a very interesting story. So you decide to go back home, to go back to school, and somewhere in there, you become a wine expert?
Well, I didn't become a wine expert, but I did discover wine. So basically what happened was, you know, as I mentioned before, I did a very, shall we say, fast lane version of college. Not to say that I didn't take it seriously. I did. I actually learned a lot and was very grateful for my time there. But because I was taking so many hours and testing out of so many things and just really like my whole life was just school. I didn't have a whole lot of hours to work, but you know, I'd already lived away from home. I'd experienced autonomy and I didn't want to just go back to not having any of that. And so, you know, you want to have enough, like at least like walking around cash or something. But it's really tough to find a job that'll only let you work one or two nights a week, you know, because when you're in college, most of the jobs you get are like serving jobs, you know, or the equivalent. And they usually want more than the amount of hours I could offer. But I ended up being connected with a friend who was managing a winery in downtown Louisville called Riverbend Winery, because it's right where the Ohio River bends. And I remember I walked in and Dave, he was my first boss. He was the best. He was a Virginia Slim smoking man. This is when you could still smoke inside. And, you know, he just always seemed to get in a classy way, like always had one sort of wafting around. And he kind of sized me up and down. And he was like, well, do you know anything about wine? And I said, no. And he said, well, can you work Friday and Saturday nights? And I said, yes. And he said, well, fine, you're hired. Because I think they were having the opposite problem. You know, it's like one employee only wants two shifts a week, but that was the only two nights of the week that the winery was open to the public. And so, you know, their scheduling needs, my scheduling needs were just in alignment. The fact that it was wine was just a happy coincidence, because I didn't know anything about it. Like when I say I didn't grow up with it, I did not grow up with any of that culture. And so just suddenly sort of being exposed to it, even if it wasn't like the most serious wine in the world, it was enough to give me a sense of like, I mean, you know, when people go to like a winery or to a tasting room or to a nice place for a glass of wine, like, you know, they get, you know, you might not like dress like you're going to a black tie gala, but you get a little gussy, you know, you get yourself looking right and you go and you sit down and just the way you hold yourself and you hold the glass and, you know, there's a je ne sais quoi to it, you know? And so I think that sort of infected me. And I thought, all right, I'm going to get into wine, whatever that means. but so I by no means became an expert, but it was enough to convince me that when I moved back to New York, I should go back for wine instead of back for acting.
So that's funny. I mentioned that at the beginning of this show, how life can throw a curveball at you. So life throws this curveball at you. You're no longer studying acting, but now you're going to get into wine. How did that happen?
Craigslist. I mean it. If they did advertisements, I'd be like their biggest endorser, man. I've met some of my best friends in the world on Craigslist, including the first job that I got when I moved back to New York. There was, you know, it's funny, like telling the story. I'm reading Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers right now. I know I'm behind the curve, but and I keep reading it. And it's like so much about like situations and, you know, yes, of course you have to work hard, but like, there's a certain amount of like, you're lucky when things happen at the right time and the right moment. And you certainly have to seize the opportunity. But like, you know, I answered an ad. I answered a lot of ads, but one of the ads was this older woman who had been a very successful fashion photographer. And in her retirement had decided that she wanted to open a little wine bar on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And I guess like from her years of, you know, traveling abroad, she had developed a passion and a sense of, you know, wine and that sort of ambiance. And she wanted to do that on the Upper East Side. And at this time there weren't that many wine bars in New York. Now they're, you know, you throw a rock, they're like a Starbucks, but back then there weren't nearly as many. And she didn't know anything about hospitality, but she knew a lot about wine. She knew enough about food, and she had already started working on developing the space. Obviously she had a good aesthetic, you know, a good eye. And I sort of answered that missing piece of the puzzle for her. I had served, you know, I've been a waitress a lot of places, and you know, I understood enough, and I was willing to work for whatever tips I got. So like, I remember the first night, the first Saturday night on the floor, it was like, you know, an 8 or 9 hour shift, and I left with $20. Man, when you got to pay rent in New York City, that's scary. That's scary anywhere. 8 hour shift for $20 anywhere is scary, but especially when you're paying New York rent. But obviously things got better from there. But you know, what she taught me was that there's this whole world of people, because she would buy wine. And so people would come to sell her wine and to talk about the wine. And that was how I realized, oh, okay, so there's this whole part of the industry that has to get the product here and present the product to people that are going to serve it to the end customer. And it's like, you know, of course, okay, supply chains, but you know, me as a young kid, I never really thought about it before. And so I think for me, what she taught me was how I could move into a different part of the industry that wasn't necessarily a serving side, like a front of the house side. So it was another good stop along the way.
So is this how you became a sommelier?
So, you know, it's one of those things that it's really sort of complicated and a little bit convoluted, right? Like, so in this country, you know, if you're a paralegal and you decide that you want to be a lawyer, it's a pretty clear path, right? You take the LSAT, you go to law school, you take the bar, now you're a lawyer. That means that now, you know, obviously a lawyer makes more than a paralegal. You know, so like your salary is going to go up, the things that you are allowed legally to do and not do change, you know, so it's like a very clear and defined path. The wine industry is not like that. So a sommelier is, it's just a job title. You could never have done a day of wine classes in your life and get a job as a sommelier. But the second you stop that job, you are no longer a sommelier. So that's the thing that's kind of like confusing about it for people. So a lot of times, like just to make it easy, I'll say like, yeah, sure, I'm a somm, because it's just a simple way through a conversation. But it, you know, being technical about it, a sommelier is a job title, right? Mm-hmm. But what you can do is you can go through, there's a number of different institutions, two big ones, which are probably the two largest globally. They're both London based. They have levels that you can work your way through that teach you the viticulture, the vinification, you know, like all the science behind growing grapes, making wine, as well as, you know, aspects of the service and business and all of that stuff. So I did go through the Wine and Spirit Education Trust through their level 4, which is their diploma of wine and spirits, which if you were going to sort of like equate it to another thing, it would kind of be like a master's. It took me about 3.5 years to finish. Lots of theses, blind tastings, written papers, stuff like that. So
I think it's fair to say that after studying like that, that not only are you a sommelier, but you're also our wine expert. But it goes a little bit deeper than that, because not only are you doing this, but you also start writing for some such publications as The New Yorker and The New York Times. So tell me about that journey.
Yeah. So basically I ended up doing, you know, after I left the wine bar, I wanted to sort of experiment with what is it that I want to do with life? You know, how am I going to, you know, incorporate like this idea of wine into something that isn't, you know, based on working in a restaurant? And I started working in marketing and events as a freelancer. And then the financial crash happened. So that was super great timing on my part. And was lucky enough to end up finding a job working in wine education for a minute. Ended up moving from there into wine distribution. So I became a sales rep. Then from there, I moved to the supplier side, which is being an importer, because a lot of, I didn't know this, and I don't think a lot of Americans do, the way alcohol is structured in this country, we have something called a 3-tier system. So the people that import the wine, the people that distribute the wine, and the people that sell the wine to the customer, like a hotel or a restaurant or a wine shop, have to be different companies. They have to be different entities. There's like a lot of stops along the way. And I've luckily gotten to work in all of them now. And when I was working for that last one, was working for the supplier, the importer, I ended up getting an opportunity to write a piece for New York Magazine that was just supposed to be a one-off piece. It was just supposed to be a lighthearted sort of fun thing, teaching a little bit about wine, but really sort of playing into, like, you know, the aspect of like Halloween candy and all of that. And much to my surprise, and I think to theirs as well, it ended up doing really well, you know, like in the clickbait SEO sort of world. They just got a lot of good response to it. And so they'd sort of asked me like, oh, you, do you want to do it again? And I said, sure, let's do it again. And before I knew it, that it was a weekly thing, which was nuts. Like, you know, it was not the path that I had intended, but it was the path that became. And then at a certain point, I started having publishers, including who I ended up going with for the book, Abrams, reaching out to me and saying, hey, you want to turn this column into a book? And me going, okay, let's, yeah, let's do that too. Wow.
So that was going to be my next question for you. Tell me about this wonderful book that you've written. What's it called?
Big Macs in Burgundy.
By the way, Big Macs in Burgundy, delicious. So tell me about this whole process. How did this happen?
Oh, man. How long you got? No. I guess, you know, I think I would have to say that the nexus of that story starts with the kindness of a neighbor. I had had loose aspirations of getting into writing, but I really, again, I had no idea. I have this habit, you know, if you can't tell, there's a theme in my story. I have no idea how to do something, but I said, I'm going to go do that and just sort of figure it out as I go. So I started trying to figure out how to write, but I didn't understand the culture of how it worked. Like, you know, you have an idea, you take it and you pitch it, you know, you tell them you want this word format and this, you know, this is the theme and blah, blah, blah. And then they tell you like, okay, give me 700 words on that. Like, I didn't know how any of that stuff worked. And my upstairs neighbor, because I've been in my building in New York for 13 years now, and he's been there for, I think, 3 or 4 more than me. So we've been neighbors for 13 years. And he is big in the publishing, writing, editing world. And so I had asked him, you know, how do I do this? And he was very kind in saying like, all right, let me try to help you. So he taught me how you craft a pitch, how you approach, you know, a publication, a house or an editor, or whatever it may be. And then he sort of coached me through pitching some pieces, one of which was to New York Magazine that eventually happened. And he was also helping me in the beginning. Not eventually, he was like, okay, this has taken on a life of its own and you got to go do you because I have a day job. But in the beginning, he was helping me with like crafting, you know, teaching me about wordsmith and, you know, all of these sort of things. So when the opportunity came to turn it into a book, the first thing that I knew was that I needed to get him on my team again. And so, you know, there may have been a lot of bourbon briberies, a lot of bottles left outside the door with very like pleading notes of, come on, man, you know, you want to do this. He's like, I absolutely did not want to do this. Writing a book is like killing yourself, which I now understand he was not joking. It is a ridiculous... I did wonder sometimes if we were going to make it to the other side, but I ended up convincing him to come on board. And from a visual standpoint, I knew that I've been creating art in the spectrum of wine for some time with one of my childhood best friends, Michelle McSwain, who has a very successful career in photography. And so I knew I wanted her to be a part of it. And the illustrator that I had been using, that we had been paired together for New York Magazine, you know, I asked him if he wanted to come on. And so I just had this like awesome team of people that I had known for forever and trusted all of their visions and their talents. And we just set out to sort of like ask ourselves, the world doesn't need another wine book. So what is this book, you know, that makes it different, right? Like, how do we set out to create something that resonates with people that wouldn't maybe necessarily identify themselves as wine people, right? Like, there's someone that enjoys a glass of wine, but not necessarily, you know, is like knee deep into it with 18 books on the bookshelf or whatever, you know? So how do we talk to them, you know, and not in a way not in a way that is patronizing or assuming that there isn't a base level of intelligence, right? Like, we're going to presume that we're talking to smart people who are just excited to learn about a topic that often feels like it has such a high barrier for entry, you know? So we're just going to chip at that wall a little bit. So that's what we set out to do.
I love it. I love it. You know, I read the book. I love the fact that you pair wine with all these different things. And usually when you hear about wine pairings, it's with these very heavy, very sophisticated meals, like foie gras and, you know, steak and salad and all that crazy stuff. But you paired wine with Cheetos.
So the Cheetos, when there's a few in the book. So in the book, there's a little over 300 food and wine pairings. About 30 of them are carryovers from the column. So we did carry some over that were like some of the more popular ones. Mm-hmm. And Cheetos being probably the one that, like, I mean, people went nuts when that piece came out. They were like, you don't pair wine with Cheetos. I'm like, why? It's food. You know what I mean? It's like, all right. But I honestly wasn't sure what to do with that when my editor, because the way it worked with the column, my editor would tell me these are the foods and then I would choose the wines. And then when I saw Cheetos, because we would do it by quarter, when I saw Cheetos in the list for the next quarter, I was going, all right, well, let's just tackle that one and see how that goes. And so I had a theory that I thought it would go good with sans serif for reasons that, you know, are technically based in understanding the physical aspects, flavor profile of sans serif. And then, you know, inherently we all know what a Cheeto tastes like, but I wasn't sure. And so, as I often did with many of my pieces when I was experimenting, I'd invited a girlfriend over. I said, you know, we'll try the Cheetos and sans serif and then we'll order some takeout and we'll, you know, we'll just hang out on the couch and catch up. And we ended up just like polishing the bottle of Cheetos or the bag of Cheetos, because like it was such a good pairing that we were like, holy crap, I just want to keep eating this. And so I don't think we ordered takeout. We just ate a giant bag of Cheetos for dinner. So, you know, for those sort of things, it's like you got to try. You know, I had a couple foods that really sort of stumped me, and it took me a little bit of doing to find the wine. But for the most part, once you understand the physiological structure of wine, how your mouth interacts with it from a like a physical standpoint, right? Like sweet, sour, salty, bitter, but then also from an aromatic standpoint, from a flavor standpoint, you can start to kind of translate that to any food, right? So it doesn't matter if it's sushi or a seaweed snack or whatever, you know what I mean? Like there's a similar vein that runs through things.
You know, this is very interesting because when I was a little bit younger, we didn't know what to do with wines. You know, we didn't, you know, I have to say back in the 90s that we had a really bad wine era. You know, we had things like wine coolers and Zima. But now you have stuff like steel barrel versus oak barrel. Tell me a little bit about the steel barrel and, versus oak barrel. What do you think about those wines?
Well, so the technical difference is that a barrel, as you said, it will impart a certain flavor profile on a wine, right? Whereas the point of stainless steel, it's not that it removes flavor. It's just that it doesn't add additional flavor. So the flavors that you get in the wine are inherently from the grape, right? They're not from anything else except the grape. So, you know, I want something like a stainless steel Pinot Grigio or Sauvignon Blanc on a hot summer day. But if it's like a chilly winter night, maybe I want an oak barrel aged Chardonnay, you know, something that's a little bit richer and rounder and warmer. So for me, you know, people are always like, pick your favorite wine. I'm like, you want me to pick my favorite child? I think it's more like, what's the mood? What's the weather? What's the food? What's the vibe? You know, like I think of oak aged wines as being something a bit like warmer, cozier, cuddlier, maybe a little sexier. Whereas I see stainless steel wines as being something that's like fresh, vibrant, more day driven, that sort of thing.
Not last summer, because COVID kind of ruined everything for us as far as going out to wineries, but the summer before that, people started to drink a new kind of wine. It wasn't white wine anymore. It was this rosé. Tell me about that whole crazy thing happening there.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you want to like talk about how crazy it is. So, in the Hamptons, right? So if you were in Long Island, you know, mm-hmm. just if you keep going a little bit further, to the South Fork, out there for restaurants, if you have a by the glass program, so you have like, you know, 5 whites by the glass, 5 reds by the glass, and maybe like 2 rosés by the glass. So, you know, 12 wines. The rosé, the entry-level rosé by the glass, would account for something like 70% of your by the glass sales. So one choice out of 12 was accounting for 70% of the sales. Crazy. The world got obsessed, which I'm okay with it. You know, like, it came out of the culture of Southern France. It came out of the culture of Provence, right? So when you go to Provence, you know, Saint-Tropez, summer, it's like, you know, we think about like the ultimate sort of like Mediterranean summer. For them, it's all about champagne and rosé. I love that people have picked up on the rosé. I think it's, you know, it's like with anything, when demand goes up, supply goes up. And sometimes that means that the quality gets to be a bit depending upon the winery. But that's, you know, it's going to be for anything. I honestly am just hoping that they catch on to the bubble part, because nobody seems to get the champagne part. And that's the part that drives me nuts. I'm always like, champagne, come on. Like, it's not just for New Year's Eve. It belongs on the summer day too. So I'm okay with the rosé thing. Yeah.
So I'm going to test you now a little bit, because I happen to know that another wine that's come back into fashion is orange wine, specifically the orange wine from Sylvania. So as you are the sommelier, tell me, what would you pair with an orange wine? What food would you pair with that?
Well, so here's the thing. I personally think that orange wine is a bit of a misnomer, right? Mm-hmm. So we've kind of gotten in, and I say we, like, you know, just general wine drinking society, have gotten in this habit of calling it orange wine, because sometimes they are orange, but they're not always orange. They could be anything from like a marigold yellow to like a deep, dark, like rustic orangish red color. Because what they are is a white wine that was fermented like a red wine. Mm-hmm. So they're fermented with the skins on, and then there's a little bit of oxidation that can happen. And that's why they develop that really funky color. So for me, with those kind of like skin contact wines, they usually have a little bit of an oxidative property to them, which means, like, think about if you bit into an apple and then you left it sitting on the counter for an hour and you came back, like, you know, the apple will be a little bit brown inside and it's going to smell a little different because the wine, the apple was exposed to oxygen. It's the same sort of thing with the fruit profile in the wine. And it's also going to have a little bit of like chewy bitterness to it, the same way that a red wine would. So with those kind of wines, I tend to like going with things like crudos, right? So like some sort of like raw fish element that's got like a sharp hit of like sea salt and maybe some earthy tones from the olive oil or the herbs that are on it, but overall like a very delicate, balanced flavor. But anything that's like sort of seafood driven, but with a nice hit of sea salt somewhere, I think tend to like really kind of like makes the skin contact wines go, you know, just sort of like explode with flavor, which is so good.
You know, since COVID, wine sales have gone up like 15%. And now after listening to this show, it's probably going to go up even higher. That sounds so good. Well, now we're at the part of the show where I'd like to find out a little bit more about you and how you work, and find out about your Quiditas, what makes you tick. So my first question to you is, what's something that people seem to misunderstand about you?
Oh, gosh. I think that people, I guess I'll take it like this. I think that people sometimes misunderstand what my aim is. Like, you know, the title of the book is a bit irreverent, and I've had a few detractors say, oh, you're just encouraging people eating junk food and fast food, and, you know, that's not okay. We're supposed to be worried about our health. And I think what's getting misunderstood there, especially if you actually like read the book, because there's an entire chapter about pairing wine with salads, pairing wine with healthy foods, pairing wine with healthy snacks, pairing wine with 2 and 3 star Michelin meals. Like, I cover a broad base of things. It's just that it's really fun to sort of focus on the sillier foods. I think the thing that gets misunderstood is that I'm not trying to be disrespectful to wine as an art or a culture. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to any of the people that spend so much time creating these amazing, you know, pieces of art in a bottle, in my opinion. I'm more trying to bring it into a space that more people feel comfortable talking about it. Right? Like, to me, it's crazy. And I mean this, I think it's crazy that, you don't, I say you, you know, we'll use you as an example. You know, I'm guessing that you might not be a, you know, an accomplished musician, but if like a song came on the radio, you would feel comfortable saying like, oh, that song's awesome, or oh, that song's dumb. Or like you might, you're not a fashion designer, but if you saw like a really like awesome suit on some guy, you'd be like, I mean, he looks great. You know what I mean? Like that's a fly suit. But yet if I said, oh, what do you think about this wine? You might go, oh, I'm not the wine expert. I don't know. You tell me. And it's like, what? That's crazy. You know what I mean? Like, of course, if you're specialized in something, you're going to have a more like nuanced opinion about it. But we can all like be a part of the conversation, right? Like it shouldn't just be for the wine experts. And that's what I'm trying to move the conversation away from. So sometimes I think that gets misunderstood. I'm just trying to make it a bigger table, you know?
What's something about your profession you'd like to debunk right now?
That everybody's a drunk. Some of us are, I'm not gonna lie, some of us are, but some of us are definitely not. You know, we drink in moderation, we don't drink every day. You know, I think it's just, I mean, I can't tell you how many times people ask me, they're like, so you just get drunk? Like, I couldn't do my job if I got drunk all the time. It seems to be a common misconception, yeah.
My next question for you is, tell me about somebody who touched your heart and how they changed your life for the better.
That's a really long list. That's like I'm fortunate to be able to say that that's like, wow. I wouldn't even know where to start. I guess if I had to pick, there was a moment. So I had mentioned earlier that I've had the brilliant idea of going full freelance in marketing and events right before the crash happened. And of course the crash happened and all the work dried up and I had no idea what I was going to do with myself. I couldn't afford my apartment. I basically thought I was going to have to like move back home again with my tail tucked between my legs and, you know, reevaluate life. And there was someone that I had gotten to know that had been a regular at the wine bar that I had gotten to be close to as a friend just in the course of them coming in. And, you know, we became friends outside of work. And he saw that I was trying really hard and that I was in a really tough situation. And so we didn't even know each other that well at that time. We were becoming friends. And he basically said, he was like, look, I got this giant place. Cause he had a huge apartment on the Upper East Side. And he was like, more bedrooms than I need. You take one, you don't need to pay me rent. Just promise me that every day you're going to get up and you're going to figure out how to get to the other side of this. And I did. It took me about 4 months. So it was like 4 months of generosity on his part. But if I hadn't had that, I would have had to have left. I had no source of income, couldn't afford my apartment, couldn't afford to eat, couldn't afford anything, couldn't find work because, I mean, I don't know if you remember, but it was, you know, it wasn't as dire as this past year with COVID, but it was bad.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a quid pro quo. It wasn't a like, hey, you can do this if you do this for me. It was just, I'm in a position to be able to help someone. And the only thing that he promised me or made me promise him was that if I got to a point in life that I could pay it forward, that I would do the same thing. And so I call him Pooks. He's like my unofficial older brother. but I would say that's someone that really touched my heart and showed me what like real generosity is.
If you could turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell her?
I'm tempted to say, don't be so hard on yourself. But I think at the same time, I think that a certain amount of being self-critical is what has helped me to continue to try new things, be adventurous, set out, you know, on new paths that I'm not really sure how to proceed. I just kind of, you know, stumble and fall until I figure out how to walk. But I think at times I've been a little too hard on myself. So I would probably tell my 18-year-old self to not be so hard on myself all the time.
Finish this sentence for me. I am most proud of.
I am most proud of my siblings. They are the most important people in the world to me. And each of them has had their own set of challenges and, you know, strife and fortune in life. And they continue to awe me. They are my best friends.
Finish this next sentence for me. I believe. Finish this next sentence for me. I believe.
I believe we've all got to keep laughing. This world is like, feels like it's burning sometimes. There's so much, you know, to wrap our heads around and try and struggle with and be better about every day. And those things are so important. But if we don't ever find joy or laughter, what's it all for? You know?
So I only have a couple more questions before we go, but one of them is, I see you have a new company. Tell me about that company.
Yeah, so I have a few, because I'm still a masochist, that hasn't changed. I have a company called The Venom Collective, which is Latin for wine. And under that umbrella, I do all different sorts of things wine related. So whether it's art or writing or video production or teaching or speaking engagements, it's all sort of under this umbrella, with the idea being that everything is sort of breaking that barrier down, right? Making the wine table bigger to include more people, not just the people that you traditionally thought of as being at that table. Beyond that, I'm also consulting on several projects that I'm excited to be a part of, one of which is a winery on the North Fork.
Oh, wow.
So in your old backyard.
Yes.
Another is a hotel restaurant project in Montauk, which I'm super excited about. We've been working on that one for almost 2 years now, so it's been a little bit in the making. So there's a few projects happening.
You are a woman with a mission. So my final question of the day is, what does the future hold for Vanessa Price?
It'll be Mavericks Montauk, which is obviously in Montauk, opening spring of 2022, as long as we continue to stay on path, knock on wood, with you know, permitting and construction, all of that. A winery project on the North Fork, which the name is yet undetermined. We just signed on to start that project last month. So that is a baby. You know, who knows? Maybe another book.
And can you tell my audience how they can get in touch with you?
So you could reach me on Instagram, you know, send a DM. I was like, when they slide in the DMs, it's at Vanessa Lenore Price. So it's just my name, VanessaLenorePrice. You can also reach me through my website, which is venomco.com. So two good places.
Vanessa, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure to have you. For you, those of you who are listening, if you want to read Big Macs and Burgundy, Wine Pairings for the Real World, you could find that book anywhere where books are sold, at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Target, you name it. That book is there. Go get it and have some fun. Vanessa, can you take us out?
I'm Vanessa Price, and I'm listening to The Quiditas Factor.
Thank you for listening to The Quiditas Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbaway. Before I let you go, please check out my website at www.mikearbaway.com. That's MikeArbaueT.com. And you can check out my shop. There you'll see a shop called Arbo Artifacts, where I have some t-shirts for sale that will help the show, as well as my wife's Etsy store, which is called Poem Jewelry Design. And Poem actually stands for Power of Each Moment. So please check out that store, because she sells a lot more than jewelry there, and it's really cool and amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I'm her husband, I'm saying it because it's true. And finally, if you can, please become a patron. Thank you for the people who are patrons so far, like Dr. James O'Brien and Ed Burns. Thank you so much, and I hope to see everyone join if they can. And please join me every Tuesday for a new episode of The Quiditas Factor. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiditas Factor with Michael J. Arbaway. We'll catch you next time.